that they drove toward Dewey at just over a walking pace. The infantry teams parked their vehicles almost a mile north of Dewey. Since they were quieter, the Dragoons' horses were tied up only a half mile away east of Dewey, in a brushy draw. As per their instructions, the team members didn't wrap the special ignition paper around their Molotovs until after they had dismounted from their vehicles and horses. The two platoons split up just before midnight. They spent more than 2 hours approaching Humboldt and Dewey at a very slow pace. They sat spread out on line. The platoon leaders walked between their respective squads, pointing out particular vehicles to torch and whispering final instructions. At 2:45 a.m., both Ian Doyle and Doug Parker started their approaches to the two towns. Parker was able to spot the sentries easily, since they were both smoking cigarettes. Approaching the first sentry from behind, he shot the man in the head from a distance of 10 feet. The bullet went through both sides of the guard's cranium, and he dropped immediately, hardly making any noise other than the sounds of his arms and legs thrashing and a low gurgling. The pistol had made a sound that was much like a hardback book being dropped on a floor. Parker approached the downed sentry, who was still twitching. Wondering if he should use his knife to slit the man's throat, he instead simply stood on his throat until he lay still. Parker then walked toward the center of Dewey, to where he knew a second sentry was seated in the passenger seat of an open-top jeep. The sentry turned toward him and asked, "Como?" Parker was 7 yards away. He raised his HK pistol and pulled the trigger. The bullet grazed the side of the man's head. Wounded, the sentry tumbled out of the jeep and ran, stumbling. Parker fired twice more but missed. The sentry ran into the nearest house and the door banged shut. Because Parker did not have a radio, word of his botched shots did not reach Dr. K for 3 minutes. Even though they had lost the element of surprise, he decided to go ahead with the attack as scheduled just 2 minutes later. Meanwhile, in Dewey, Ian Doyle had approached the nearest sentry at a normal walking pace. He thought it was best to appear nonchalant. Ian said quietly, "Hola." At a distance of less than 3 paces, the guard realized that he didn't recognize Doyle, but by then it was too late. Ian raised the M10, which was loaded with subsonic ammo. The gun selector was set to semi-automatic. It coughed twice, and bullets hit the sentry in the cheek and forehead. The man's head snapped backward, and he dropped into a twitching heap. With the large psionics suppressor attached, the Ingram didn't make much more noise than a loud hand clap. It didn't even alarm nearby dogs. Ian soon repeated the process with the other two sentry positions that they had scouted out before. The first was sitting on a Chinese nylon-folding camp chair in front of a bank-armored car. He never made it out of his chair. The other one was standing on a driveway with his back to Doyle, sipping from a wine bottle. Only this last sentry made any significant noise when his wine bottle and Romanian AK clattered as they fell on the concrete slab driveway. Ian glanced at his watch. It was 3:10 a.m. He was pleased that La Fuerza was still oblivious to their presence. He knelt and twisted the M10's cocking handle 90 degrees, putting it in a safe position. Then he replaced the partially expended magazine with a full one from his satchel. Realizing that things would soon get very noisy, he flipped the gun selector switch to the full auto position. The three Humboldt squads crept forward, keeping roughly on line. Lars raised a clenched fist, and the signal was passed down the line, signaling a halt. He checked his watch. It was 3:11 a.m. Ian Doyle trotted up to Lane and whispered,
"I got all three guards. I think the gang is still asleep and clueless."
They shook hands, and Lars said,
"Good job, Ian. You can get back to your squad."
Lars waited, watching the nearby houses and frequently glancing down at his wristwatch. At precisely 3:15 a.m., he shouted, "Now!" They all started throwing their Molotovs at the parked vehicles. The firebombs burst into flames, making surprisingly little noise but lots of light. But then the shooting started, and it soon rose in an ear-shattering crescendo. A few of the Molotov jars failed to break, but most of these were soon deliberately broken by rifle fire. Any vehicle that wasn't immediately set ablaze became the recipient of some of the remaining firebombs. There were so many Molotovs exploding that the street was lit up almost like daylight. After the firebombs were expended, most of the raiders dropped down prone and continued shooting. Lars fired half a magazine from his Valmet M62, aiming carefully at muzzle flashes or movement inside the house windows. The volume of rifle fire from the houses soon surpassed that coming from the raiders. Lane could hear bullets snapping by and felt one bullet catch the brim of his boonie hat, nearly tugging it off his head. Lane saw a man to his right go down hard. He was kicking and clutching his chest. Lars ran to him and saw that he had been hit twice in the upper abdomen and was gushing blood. The worst of the two wounds was next to his sternum. Lane had seen a wound like that, a heart hit, once before, when he was in Iraq. He saw that the man was a member of the infantry team. Two tracer bullets whizzed by, uncomfortably close. Realizing that the man would be dead in moments, Lars dashed away to get out of the line of fire. After running behind some brush, Lars stopped and knelt down. He leaned his Valmet up against a rock and pulled out a pop flare cylinder that he had earlier removed from its shipping tube. He fumbled with his prosthetic hand, slipping the flare's cap onto its base. He slammed it on the ground. After a bang and a whoosh, a Red Star cluster flare burst 200 feet above him. That was the pre-planned signal to withdraw. Lane snatched up his Valmet and bellowed above the gunfire, "Alphas, cover! Bravos, move!" He deliberately fired the rest of the magazine wherever he saw movement or muzzle flashes in the houses occupied by La Fuerza. A stream of tracer bullets from one of La Fuerza's machine guns went over his head. As he reached the bottom of his magazine, Pat Redmond ran by with his M1A at the high port position, shouting, "Let's get the flock out of here!" Now Lars shouted, "Bravos, cover! Alphas, move!" He jumped up and trotted to the rear, reloading his rifle as he ran. His rubber hand made reloading cumbersome. He dropped the empty magazine into the dump pouch on his belt, just as he had done in Iraq and Afghanistan. After traversing 50 feet, he stopped and turned to kneel and aim his rifle. He shouted, "Alphas, cover! Bravos, move!" He fired an entire magazine, shooting roughly once per second at any likely targets. Then he shouted, "Bravos, cover! Alphas, move!" He ran another bound, again reloading as he ran. In this leapfrogging motion, Lane's dragoon team got over the hill in relative safety. Lars noticed that Hector Ruiz had his rifle slung, while all the others had theirs held at high port. They quickly counted off and formed a ranger file. They jogged 200 yards over a second hill to their horses. With so much running while carrying a heavy load, Lars was winded by the time he reached Scrappy. The horse was prancing in place, obviously nonplussed by the gunfire and explosions. To his right, he saw that Joanna was looping the sling of her Galil over her saddle horn. Just as he was about to put a foot in the stirrup, Hector Ruiz ran up with his rifle still slung and clutching his left arm to his chest. He grunted, "I got a little problem here, Joanna." Hector pulled back the sodden sleeve of his ACU shirt to display a nasty grazing wound that ran up the back of his forearm. The deep gash was 8 inches long and spurting blood at the upper end. Pat Redmond held a red-lens penlight to provide Joanna enough light to see what she was doing as she positioned a combat application tourniquet on Hector's biceps. Then she strapped a large bandage over the wound. As she worked, Joanna told Ruiz,
"Let's ride a couple of miles, and then we can stop and I'll staple this up. If we somehow get separated, loosen this cat tourniquet after 20 minutes. If it starts bleeding a lot, then retighten it as needed, but don't leave it on for more than 30 minutes at a time."
She seemed concerned that the bullet had chipped a bone in Hector's elbow.
"We'd better get moving," Lane urged. "I don't want to be here when those bad attitudes come over the hill. That may be in just a couple of minutes."
"Yeah, we better go. I'll be okay," Hector agreed.
Joanna nodded. "I'll keep my horse right behind you, Hector." Lane's team quickly mounted their horses and rode north. As they rode, they could see the majority of the infantry team streaming over the hills, heading east. Lars felt good, knowing they'd be back at their vehicles and out of the area before daylight. The two squads that attacked Humboldt didn't fare nearly as well as the Dewey teams. When they threw their Molotovs and started shooting, they were answered with withering return fire. The extent of their casualties did not become apparent until they returned to Prescott.
Chapter 43 Escape and Evasion. The moment the idea is admitted into society that property is not as sacred as the law of God, and that there is not a force of law and public justice to protect it, anarchy and tyranny commence. If thou shalt not covet, and thou shalt not steal, were not commandments from heaven, they must be made inviolable precepts in every society before it can be civilized or made free. John Adams, A Defense of the Constitution of the United States Against the Attacks of M. Turgot, 1787. Blanca's instructions were simple.
Stay with the vehicles. If our trucks get spotted by anyone from La Fuerza before the scheduled kickoff time for the raid, then radio the team leaders and let them know immediately.
She waited, listened, and prayed, clutching her Mini 14 GB. Then she heard shooting and explosions in the distance, right on time. An hour later, she heard the team start to return, crashing through the brush. Ian was with them, but Alex was not. In accordance with their plans, all the vehicles departed at 5:30 a.m. Everyone had been warned that if they didn't make it to the parking area by then, they'd be on their own to E&E their way back to Prescott. Back at the Conley Ranch's clubhouse, they had an anxious day of waiting. Stragglers came in, only two of them wounded. At just after 5 p.m., Ian greeted a man in his 50s who had just arrived. He was carrying two rifles, an M1 Garand in his hands, and a Ruger Mini 14 slung across his back. Ian recognized a distinctive camouflage sling on the Mini 14. This rifle belonged to his brother, Alex. He asked the man, "Where's Alex?" Looking glum, the man shook his head slowly from side to side in response.
"He got shot bad. Through a lung. We couldn't stop the bleeding."
"Did he say anything before he died?"
"No. Sorry, he was just coughing, and then he died."
Ian's eyes welled up.
"Wow.
Thanks for letting me know." "You can keep that Ruger," he said.
The man shook Ian's hand and thanked him, and then he turned to go check in formally with Dr. K. That evening, the four families began frantically packing up their gear, their clothing, and their meager supply of remaining stored food. Two of the families decided to move to a fairly heavily defended compound in Prescott Valley. They'd take a circuitous route, looping around to avoid La Fuerza's suspected avenue of advance. The other two families, led by Dr. K, had decided to leave the region entirely. They would travel in two RVs and four SUVs. One of the SUVs
was Alex's Ford Excursion. This vehicle, along with nearly all of Alex's gear, had been given to Dr. K by Ian. Ian explained that even if he had wanted it, the cramped space and weight limitations of the two Lerons were unforgiving. All that Ian kept from Alex's room was some 5.56mm NATO ammunition and 9 Mini 14 magazines. Previously, Alex had explained to Blanca to beware of using anything except original Ruger factory-made magazines in her rifle. All of the other brands of magazines, the aftermarket ones, are jam-o-matic junk, he warned. Dr. K offered to have Ian and Blanca come with him in his Fleetwood diesel pusher RV. But without trailers, there would be no way to take the Lerons. Ian answered him quickly. Thanks for the offer, but I'd rather stick with what we know best, and that's flying. Let's just wish each other Godspeed. Ian Doyle had already toyed with the idea of paralleling the route that they had planned to take the RVs, leapfrogging from airport to airport. But he concluded that his best chance of finding a truly safe refuge before either running out of fuel or running out of luck was to head to Todd Gray's retreat in north-central Idaho. Lars had an anxious morning, waiting for his infantry team to arrive. He penned an after-action report and asked to have it delivered to Dr. K. Bob Potts was the last one back, arriving at 11 a.m. He was dripping with sweat. By the time he arrived, the horses were already loaded in trailers, and the rest of the team was packed up and ready to go. After some handshakes and a long pull on a canteen, Potts and the others climbed aboard the pickups. There was no ceremony. There was no celebration. They had done what needed to be done, and they were just happy to be heading home. Lars was anxious to be well away from La Fuerza before they had the chance to regroup. Hector's arm was decorated with a new row of 37 surgical staples. He said the arm was painful, but regular doses of pain meds from Joanna Visser made it manageable. Other than Hector's wound, Lars' team got away unscathed. They drove beyond Flagstaff to Winona the first night and camped just off Twin Arrows Road east of town. They were all edgy and had difficulty sleeping. Shortly after they left the next morning, they were surprised to see a small herd of elk on a hillside just above the road. They braked to a halt, and Chad Stenerson rested his scoped M1A across the hood of the lead pickup. He dropped a cow and a bull in rapid succession. This took 6 shots. The other elk fled into the nearby timber. In less than an hour, the elk that had been shot were gutted and dragged down to the pickups. With all 8 members of the team working together, dragging the elk down to the trucks was relatively easy, but it took considerable effort to get them up on the fuel trailer. After that, the rest of the trip home was speedy and trouble-free. With 2 of the gold coins that he had earned from the Humboldt raid, Lars bought 2 9mm pistols, a Glock 17 and a Glock 19. These used magazines that were largely interchangeable, although the short magazines from the Model 19 would not work in the longer-gripped Model 17. Together, the 2 pistols came with just 5 magazines and 1 holster. He badly wanted some more magazines, but they were a scarce commodity. Few people were willing to part with any extra magazines. As one Navajo vendor explained it to Beth, "In bad times, when people are shooting at you, what exactly is a spare magazine? There's no such thing. You can never have too many. Same thing for ammo." The only magazines that the Lanes often saw regularly offered for sale at the flea market were military surplus M16 alloy 30-round magazines, which had been produced in huge numbers. But even those now had ridiculously high asking prices. Seeing the depleted shelves and such high prices on a visit to Zia's Sporting Goods in Farmington, Beth commented, "We really should have invested in magazines and ammunition. It would have been a better investment than silver."
Lars sighed and replied, "Yeah, you're right. Ammo is practically worth its weight in silver these days, and magazines are a you-name-your-price kind of item."
Lars would have actually preferred to have bought a couple of SIG P226 or P228 pistols to be compatible with Andy's first pistol, but those were much more scarce than Glocks. In the new age of Deep Schumer, beggars couldn't be choosers. He also realized that his chances of eventually finding spare Glock magazines was much better than finding spare SIG magazines, since Glocks were made in much larger numbers.
Chapter 44. Ignis. Vengeance has no foresight. Napoleon Bonaparte. Ignacio was furious. He spent the hours before sunrise running from house to house, assessing the damage. He radioed his cousin Simon in Humboldt. Adding Simon's tally, he concluded that every one of La Fuerza's armored vehicles had been destroyed by fire. So were more than half of the pickups and vans. Further, more than half of the gang's loot, ammo, and fuel were gone, destroyed in the fire and explosions. Some 26 of his men and 3 women had been killed. Another 15 men had been wounded, and of those, 3 were not likely to live. Only one of the men who had attacked them had been captured. He lived under torture only long enough to tell them that the raiders had originated from Prescott. Ignacio was whipped up into a genuine frenzy. He ran from truck to truck, screaming, "Bastardos! Venganza! Venganza! Matenlos a todos!" Bastards! Vengeance! Vengeance! Slaughter them all! They spent the next day and a half salvaging what they could from the wrecked vehicles and requisitioning more pickups and vans from all over Humboldt and Dewey. They ended up with an odd assortment. Several were bright colors, but that didn't matter. They just needed enough to get all of his men to Prescott. He was going there soon and going for blood. 2 days after the raid, they had stolen enough trucks and vans to have room for everyone to ride. Simon and Tony met with Ignacio Garcia over lunch. Simon asked,
"What is the plan of operations?"
Garcia grunted,
"We drive to Prescott and we burn it down." "That's the plan? The entire plan?" "Here is the entire plan. We go there, and we burn the city to the ground, and we kill everyone. I mean, everyone. And their children, and their dogs, and their chickens, and their goats."
Simon nodded gravely. He knew that Ignacio was still extremely angry, and that he wouldn't take any advice. So he merely echoed,
"Okay, we go to Prescott tomorrow, and we kill them all."
After a pause, Simon added,
"I'll have everyone go look for more road flares."
Chapter 45. Bug Out. It is an uphill struggle, but I wish that we could distinguish more carefully between freedom and liberty. These conditions are not the same, though they are certainly related. Freedom is the absence of restraint, a physical circumstance. Liberty, on the other hand, is a political situation denoting the lawful capability of the citizen to defend himself and his near and dear without interference from the state. Note that the Declaration of Independence forcibly and particularly establishes the blessings of liberty upon ourselves and our posterity. I like to carry a pocket copy of the Declaration, plus the Constitution, in my travels. It is a good thing to have in hand when discussions arise. The late Colonel Jeff Cooper. By Dr. Kay's count, only 31 members of the raiding party had returned to Prescott by the next evening. And of those, only 3 had been slightly wounded. Joanna said bluntly,
There's no in-between with high-velocity rifle bullets. It's usually either something minor or you bleed out, deader than disco.
La Fuerza didn't arrive the next day, or even the day after. The towns of Prescott Valley and Prescott were in a state of alarm following the raid. Even though the raid was deemed a success, they had clearly stirred up a hornet's nest. Then they heard on the CB that Prescott Valley had been bypassed and that La Fuerza was heading directly toward Prescott. Blanca paced the bedroom. She asked Ian,
"What do you think will happen? I mean, you burned up most of their vehicles, but you say that you maybe killed just a few of La Fuerza."
"They're going to be out for blood, that's for sure. They have to know that we came from somewhere close by. Worst case is they captured one of our missing in action and they made them talk. That would mean that they'd head straight for Conley Ranches. It will be a total freaking bloodbath."
Blanca half shouted,
"Then we've got to go! At least be 100% ready to go, muy pronto."
Ian and Blanca soon assembled and fueled their planes. They packed everything aboard that they could, leaving very little room. They waited for an indication that the looter army was heading toward Prescott.
"Maybe we can get up to Idaho. Two of my old college buddies, Dan Fong and Todd Gray, are up there. They're survivalists. You remember me talking about them, right? Dan is a total gun nut. He must have 24 guns. Todd set up a real survival retreat up there. It's stocked with years' worth of stored food, gardening seeds, fuel tanks, the whole works. The Fong man is part of that retreat group. If anybody is still alive and kicking after the crunch, it's got to be them. With our skills, they'll probably take us in."
"Probably? Maybe. But isn't a lot to go on."
"Our only other option is about to be overrun. Todd's place in Idaho is the only place I can think of that'll be safe."
As they climbed, they could see below that almost half the buildings in downtown Prescott were ablaze. Blanca keyed her microphone and said simply,
"Ay, ay, ay."
Following a sectional aviation chart, Blanca navigated the pair of Lerons to Cedar City, Utah. The airport was on the northwest side of town, just west of I-15. Upon landing there, they were surprised to find 100 LL Avgas was being offered for sale at the airport. The FBO operator told Ian that he had recently taken the gas out of hiding because word had come that they'd soon get a fresh supply coming from Oklahoma.
"I might as well sell off the last 110 gallons of my old gas, since the new stuff is coming in from the provisional government," he said.
"What provisional government?" Ian asked.
"Fort Knox. Haven't you heard?"
the airport manager answered.
"Nothing solid, just some rumors."
"So that's for real?"
"Sure it is. We're going to have some kind of UN regional administrator. But they promised us local autonomy."
Ian cocked his head and asked,
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Well, we don't know yet, but hey, any government is better than no government."
Ian gave his wife a glance and then commented,
"Well, in my book, there is only one rightful form of government, a constitutional republic, or I'd rather have no government. One of my college professors was a heavy-duty libertarian. He wore a lapel button that said, 'There's no government like no government.'"
Blanca chimed in,
"I second that motion."
In the end, Ian traded an Olin 12-gauge flare gun kit, 100 rounds of 9mm ball ammunition, and $20 worth of junk silver for 43 gallons of gasoline. The FBO manager let them sleep in a mostly empty hangar next to their planes. The next day, grossly overweight, they took an extra-long roll and took off. They followed I-15 and occasional GPS fixes to the long paved strip north of Brigham City, Utah. Aside from some bumpy air,
the flight was uneventful. They carried with them a brief letter of introduction from the FBO manager in Cedar City. This was handed to his cousin, who ran the airport at Brigham City. Their reception there was friendly, but it was obvious that food was in short supply. One of the men at the airport confided that Mormons from all over the country had descended on Utah just as the crunch set in. They all had relatives here, so it seemed safe. The problem is that Utah consumes more food than it produces locally, so even though a fair number of families had stocked up in accordance with the church guidelines, all that stored food is gone by now. People are gardening like crazy, but a lot of places have very limited water. So unless those big Albertsons and Safeway grocery trucks start rolling again soon, there's going to be starvation here. Plain and simple. That's why everyone's so anxious to see the provisional government. Ian and Blanco spent 2 days in Brigham City. In 3 separate transactions, they bought 41 gallons of gas. This cost Ian $11 in junk silver, 200 rounds of 9mm hollow point ammo, a hammer, a pair of snap ring pliers, and a Fluke brand volt ohm meter. Ian was troubled by the quality of some of the gasoline, which had not been stabilized. There were paraffin streamers visible in it, so he laboriously took all the gasoline and filtered it through a chamois car polishing cloth into a large drum. He then added a bottle of Gold Eagle brand 104 plus octane booster and part of a bottle of alcohol. The alcohol, as he explained to Blanca, would absorb any water in the gasoline. They let the gasoline settle overnight. The morning before they departed, Ian pumped it out of the barrel, again through a filter, and filled their various tanks, bladders, and bottles. They left the last 2 gallons of the gas behind in the bottom of the drum, just in case. The next day of flying brought them to Grangeville, Idaho. Seeing the patchwork of fields on the Camas Prairie reassured Ian. He toggled his mic switch and said, "Ay, Mira Conchita, this is big-time agricultural country. I don't think anybody is styling up there." The airport sat at the north edge of town. After several inquiries, they were able to barter for just 23 gallons of gas. For this, Ian spent their last $10 in junk silver and traded another 120 of their 9mm ball cartridges. Again, they spent the night in a hangar. Blanca mentioned that their breakfast brought their food supply down to just a couple of days.
"You know, Ian, at the rate we are burning through our silver and ammo, we are cutting this little venture pretty close," she warned.
"I know, I know. We just have to pray hard and trust that the Fong man and Todd are still there."
The next day there was foggy weather, but the fog looked thin. They climbed into brilliant sunlight, and they continued north over the Camas Prairie and then over the Clearwater River Valley to Beauville, Idaho, on the eastern fringe of the Palouse Hills. Approaching Beauville, they saw that the terrain was rolling and mostly wooded. Low on fuel, their planes were now considerably lighter. There was no airport at Beauville, but they were able to land on Highway 8, just west of town. The hamlet was so small that they just taxied up Highway 9 to the junction of Highway 3. Landing so close to town got everyone's attention. A swarm of children and teenagers ran up to the planes just after they shut down their engines. In answer to the Doyles' queries, a local woman said that she knew Todd and Mary Gray, said that they were safe and well, and explained how to find their ranch house. A few minutes later, she brought the Doyles a road map and a Clearwater National Forest map. On the latter, she pinpointed the ranch. The flight to the ranch took only 3 minutes. Blanca spotted the Quonset-style barn that was opposite the Gray's property. As they circled, they could see a woman armed with a rifle in a large, fenced garden behind the house. Ian thumbed the mic switch for his ICOM transceiver and said delightedly, "There it is, Blanca!
That's definitely Todd's house. It's just the way the Fong man described it.
Eyeing the trees below, Ian judged that the breeze was light. They circled and sequentially touched down on the gravel county road with Blanca taking one extra orbit. They taxied until Ian's Lehrer was opposite the Gray's Lane and mailbox. As they shut down their engines, Blanca radioed,
"I sure hope we'll be welcome here."
Ian touched his mic switch and responded,
"I trust that we will be. We just have to live by faith."
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Survivors, a novel of the coming collapse by James Wesley Rawls. Copyright 2011 by James Rawls. Performed by Dick Hill. Directed by Susie Breck. Performance copyright 2011 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brilliancedaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.